There is a very interesting pasuk that finds its way into the beginning of Bishalach. Bishalach, we're in having left Mitzrayim, of course, leading towards Kriyas Yamsuf. Within the opening psukim of the parsha, Perik Yud Gimel Pasuk Yud Tes, the pasuk reads, "Vayikach Moshe es Atmos Yosef Imo." Moshe took Yosef's bones with him. Ki hashbea eshbea es b'nei Yisrael le'mor, for Yosef had endured b'nei Yisrael to take an oath to him and said, "Pakod yufkod olakim eschem, Hashem will take account of you, and when he does, v'alisim es atmosai mizeh itchem." So you should take me with you. I say it's interesting because to place this pasuk at the beginning of Bishalach seems an unusual location. After all, B'nai Yisrael have left Mitzrayim in Parshas Bo. Yosef's bones can't be with Moshe unless he took him at the end of Parshas Bo, or in the middle even. How then does this come to be in the beginning of Bishalach? It seems to be put in as a postscript. They left, and when they left, and by the way, Moshe took Yosef's bones with him. And be that as it may, there's a very interesting comment of the Gemara in Maseches Sota on Daf Yud Gimel Omed Aleph with regards to Moshe taking Yosef's bones. The Gemara reads, "Bo re'e, come and see kama chavivos mitzvos al Moshe Rabbeinu. See how beloved mitzvos are to Moshe." How so? For what was everyone involved with on the night before they left Mitzrayim? Shekol Yisrael kulon nisasku bebiza, or the correct pronunciation is beviza, but not the same type of visa. But v'hu nisasek bemitzvahs. Moshe was involved in mitzvahs. They're all getting spoils, gold and silver. Moshe's involved in mitzvahs. Moshe alone. Shene emar, in fulfillment of what the pasuk says in Mishlei Perek Yud, chacham leiv yikach mitzvahs. Someone who is wise, he takes mitzvahs. If you want to know the difference between Moshe and everyone else was getting gold and silver, and Moshe was involved in mitzvahs. Well, many mefarshim raise a simple question, and that is that it happens to be on that occasion that everyone was involved in mitzvahs, because taking gold and silver was also the fulfillment of a mitzvah. Acharichen Yitzhu B'chush Gadol. The one time in history when going around pursuing and collecting gold and silver was a mitzvah. It hasn't been a mitzvah since. We like to keep in practice, just in case. So why then do we look at Moshe as the only one involved in mitzvahs? Everyone was involved in mitzvahs. Well, the premise behind the question, firstly, needs to be examined. And the reason why is because we refer back to a discussion we had last week in Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Beis, where the collecting of the gold and silver was prefaced with the words daber na ba'ozne ha'am, speak please. Rashi there tells us, ein na ela loshen bakosha. It's a request to Moshe. Why is it a request to Moshe? As HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, it's from the Gemara in Brachos on Daf Tes, Shelo Yom Oso Tzadik Avram, that Avram shouldn't say, Va'avodim V'inu Osam Kiyem Bahem, that you fulfilled with them the part of the Brisbane Abisorim of the persecution and the enslavement, Va'avodim V'inu Osam, V'acharechen Yetzu B'chush Gadol Lo Kiyem Bahem, and you didn't fulfill the good ending, the part at the end which says that afterwards they will leave with great riches. And we noted at the time it's rather unusual that the background or the launch of collecting the gold and silver should be phrased as a request, and moreover that it should be because Avram shouldn't complain. That's the reason. After all, if Hashem said Acharichen Yetzu B'chush Gadol, that's why. It shouldn't just be that Avram shouldn't complain. But whatever the answer to that is, Reb Velvel Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, suggests that because the gold and silver was not actually in fulfillment of Rechush Gadol itself, but rather a request for the benefit of Avram that he should not complain. Therefore, technically, it was not in fulfillment of a mitzvah. After all, what is a mitzvah? A mitzvah is a command, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands to do, an instruction. This was not a command, it was a request. And therefore, if you wish to know who was involved in mitzvos on that evening, actually there's room to say it was only Moshe Rabbeinu, because Bnei Yisrael were involved in fulfilling a request, but not a mitzvah proper. That's the suggestion of the Brisker Rav, and in fact, it's interesting that in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Lamed Hei, which describes them collecting the gold and silver, it says, Uvnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe. They did what Moshe told them. It doesn't say they did what Moshe said, kashetziva Hashem biyad Moshe. But rather, kidvar Moshe, they're simply responding to Moshe, and Moshe is requesting this on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's behalf. It's interesting to note that there is precedent for this idea of the Brisker Rav, that Daber Na, when it says a bakasha, when it's expressed as a request, it's a request and not actually a mitzvah. That is a discussion that is already to be found in the Drushas Haran, where he discusses the Akedah. And as we know, another famous Na in the Torah is Akedah Yitzchak, where Hashem says, Kach Na, Et bincha, et yichidcha. And Rashi also there states, Ein na el aloshen bakasha. We've mentioned in the past, it's a very important parshanut question. When Rashi says, Ein x el aloshen y, the question is, does he mean to say, this is a general rule, this is always true? Or does he mean to say specifically, in this instance, it's clear that it is none other than the following expression? Mizrahi, for example, maintains that when Rashi says "Ein na ela loshen bakasha," and he says it, I think, 8 times in the course of his parish on the Torah, he means to say that it is the case for those 8 times. He doesn't mean to present it as a klal, and that actually receives support because there are other definitions that Rashi gives. For example, that dibur is loshen kasha, and that amira is loshen raka, which he speaks about in Bamidbar Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Aleph, and there Rashi introduces by saying, Ein dibur ha'amur b'chol makom ela loshen kasha. The ein amira ha'amura b'chol makom ela loshen raka. That seems to imply that when it's a principle, Rashi will present it as a principle. If he just states it, then it is a local discussion. But be that as it may, Rashi comments that also when it came to him, uses the expression of na, that people shouldn't say, harishonos ein bahem mamash, the first 9 tests, nu, okay, there was not too much to them, if you fulfill this test, then everyone will be satisfied. How they could say such a thing, I'm not entirely sure, but there too, Ran comments in the drushas on the word na, and states explicitly that this was not a mitzvah for Avram. When Hashem says kach na, it was absolutely a request, as if to say, says Ran, had Avram for whatever reason refused and said, you know, I'd really like to keep Yitzchak, it would not have been considered remiss of him at all. It was purely a bakasha that he could choose, bertsoso, memale, bertsoso, not memale. In the event, of course, he chose to go ahead with it, and the rest is for us is history. But nonetheless, we see the Ran is a precursor for what Rav Velvel Soloveitchik is saying, that when the word na denotes a bakasha, it means a bakasha and not a mitzvah. The Akedah for Ran was the bakasha and not a mitzvah. Kach daber na ba'ozni ha'am for the gold and silver was a bakasha and not a mitzvah. The only one therefore involved in mitzvos was Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the approach of the Brisker Rav. However, it should be pointed out that not all are in agreement, even amongst Rishonim, that when the word na means a request, it means a request and not a mitzvah. There's a very interesting tshuva of the Truma Sadeshen, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, who's one of the great later Rishonim, and he discusses a case where someone left at Tzava, he left his will, and one of the things he said is, Avakesh Mikem, I would request of you, with regards to a certain situation, whatever it was actually a young lady who was unmarried when he passed away. She said, if she finds a shidduch, she owes me money, cancel all her debts. That's my request for you. Well, the heirs wanted to know, is that binding? As if to say, he requested. Tzava'a is normally the will, meaning instructions. This wasn't phrased as an instruction. It was phrased as a request. Does that mean it's a request that they can choose to fulfill or not fulfill? Or is it illegal for them or wrong for them not to fulfill it? And the Trumas Hadeshin was asked this question. And Trumas Hadeshin answers and says, you should know that when one phrases something as a request, if the setting and the natural setting is that of command and instruction, phrasing it as a request only adds to the situation. It doesn't take away from it. It doesn't mean that it's less than instruction. It's an instruction with added exhortation. And my proof, says Trumas Hadeshin, is the Akedas Yitzchak, where Hashem says, Kach no es binucha, and there is no question, says Trumas Hadeshin, that was a mitzvah. The no only came to add more. And how do I know that that the Akedah was actually a mitzvah? Well, interestingly, we learn principles about mitzvahs from Akedas Yitzchak. What do we learn? Most things we do not learn from Akedas Yitzchak. But what do we learn from Akedas Yitzchak? Well, the Pasuk tells us, after having been told about the Akedah, Vayashkem Avram Baboker. Avram got up early in the morning, from which the Gemara in Psachim in the first Perek derives, Mikan Shezrizim Makdimim LeMitzvahs. You see, those that are zrizim, energetic, they perform mitzvahs at the earliest possible opportunity. Says Trumas Hadeshin, just reading simply, but if you tell me that when Avram got up for the Akedah, we learned from there zrizim and dimin lemitzvahs, it sounds like what he himself was involved in was a mitzvah. And thus I say that even though the word no has the bakosha, bakosha only adds to the mitzvah, doesn't take away. Which means that we actually have before us what we could call a machlokas, amongst the later Rishonim, as to whether the word na indicates lack of mitzvah or mitzvah plus. And if it's mitzvah plus, then in a sense, our question comes back. If everyone was involved, why does the Gemara say that only Moshe was involved in mitzvahs? Well, I came across a fascinating answer to this question, which I think is very meaningful, and that is to preface. By referring to the Pasuk from Mishlei, which is quoted, which really sums up the whole thing. The Gemara says, everyone was taking gold and silver, and Moshe was taking mitzvahs. You see, as the Pasuk says in Mishlei, Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvahs. The wise of heart takes mitzvahs. Well, two questions. Firstly, what is a Chacham Lev? What is that? Someone who's wise of heart? How many people are like that? And are they the only people who do mitzvahs? I submit that most people do mitzvahs. I mean, anyone who's doing what they should be doing does mitzvahs. They're not all called Chachmei Lev, they're called Jews, and they do mitzvahs. So why does the Pasuk seem to limit the performance of mitzvahs to Chacham Lev? It's good to be a Chacham Lev, but I would say that's a subcategory, but there's a much broader category of people that do mitzvahs. Yet at the same time, we note that the Pasuk states Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvahs, someone who's wise of heart takes mitzvahs. And that's also an unusual expression. After all, when we describe a person who is mitzvah observant, I think we'd use many terms before we'd use the term he takes mitzvahs. We'd say he does mitzvahs, he's a shomer Torah mitzvahs, mekayim mitzvahs. We don't say about someone, oh, he takes mitzvahs, he's a lokeach mitzvahs. There's no such term in our lexicon. And yet the Pasuk in Mishlei says, Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvahs. And that's why some Meforshim say that the Pasuk here isn't talking about doing mitzvahs. It's talking about taking mitzvahs. But what is the concept of taking mitzvahs? What it means is that everyone has the things that they prize, the things that they treasure, the things that they value especially. Those are the things that they take. Those are the things that they hoard. Those are the things that they collect. Those are collectibles for them. But what are those things? It varies from person to person. For some people it's money, for some people it's other things. And for a certain type of person, it's mitzvahs. What type of person is that? Everyone knows that mitzvahs are the most valuable thing that exists. Everyone knows that. However, as much as most people know that intellectually, But the things that they treasure may yet be other things, because what's in your heart is what you treasure, what you value in your heart. A chacham lev is a very specific type of person, and that is someone whose chokhmah has reached his heart. That means he knows, he feels emotionally what he knows to be true intellectually. What everyone knows that mitzvahs are the most valuable thing, that's how he feels viscerally and emotionally. And therefore, that's he collects, a person like that collects mitzvahs. Everyone does mitzvahs. Chachamim do mitzvahs, and Jews do mitzvahs. But chachmei lev take mitzvahs. And how does that relate to us? When we come back to the evening before Yetzias Mitzrayim, Daber na ba'oz deha, and as we raise the question, what was the impetus for taking the gold and silver? Rashi says it's a request. But Avram shouldn't complain. And our question was, what's it got to do with Avram? I mean, there's a prior and more compelling reason. You said they'd leave Beruchush Gadol. However, says the Dubna Magid, the promise of Beruchush Gadol was not about gold and silver. Beruchush Gadol, the great treasure with which we left Mitzrayim, was not these vessels, but rather it was the qualities that we had attained through our experiences in Mitzrayim that enabled us and prepared us to receive. That is the Rechush Gadol. Interestingly, if there's a nuance here, if we pay attention to it, for we're told here that we'll leave Rechush Gadol. Elsewhere in Chumash, earlier in fact, we're told of people who had great material assets. That's Yaakov and Esav. They couldn't live together because they had so much livestock and so much assets that the land didn't contain them. The pasuk says, "Ki hayar ruchusham rav, v'lo yachlu l'sheves yachtov." Their property was great. So when you talk about physical assets, the term is ruchush rav, because rav is quantities. Here the pasuk says, does not say va'acherichen yitzu beruchush rav. It says va'acherichen yitzu beruchush gadol. Beruchush gadol are qualities. There's a great asset that they will leave with. And that's Matan Torah. And therefore, the real fulfillment of Rechush Gadol was leaving Mitzrayim to receive the Torah. So where does the gold and silver come in? That's why Rashi says, because most people, when you talk about Rechush Gadol, do not immediately think or do not instinctively think of Torah and mitzvahs, even though they know they should. And if they're talking to from people, that's probably what they'll say. But their emotional reaction is probably to things like gold and silver. And therefore, as an act of kindness to Avram, and Avram will say that in their terms they underwent the enslavement and persecution. So is it not at least fitting that they should leave with treasure in their terms, even though it's not the real treasure? They'll learn, and they'll develop, and they'll reach a point, hopefully, where they'll understand that Torah and mitzvahs is the ultimate treasure. But in the meanwhile, they should leave with nothing. And therefore, that's a kindness to Avram. Which means that for most people, when they hear the words Rechush Gadol, they think of gold and silver. But there's one exception, and that's Moshe Rabbeinu. The amazing thing about the situation, as Moshe goes for Yosef's bones, and everyone else goes for gold and silver, is that they were both in fulfillment of the same pasuk, which is Achrechein Yitzu Rechush Gadol. The difference between them is, what do you think of when you hear the words Rechush Gadol? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, we're leaving Mitzrayim. It's time now to leave with great treasure. Everyone else makes a beeline for the gold and silver, and Moshe makes a beeline for a rare mitzvah. Except, what does that tell us about Moshe? It tells us that when Moshe hears Rechush Gadol, he thinks mitzvahs in fulfillment of the pasuk, Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvahs. Someone whose wisdom had penetrated and permeated his heart, treasure for him at mitzvahs, and therefore here you see the uniqueness of Moshe. It's not an indictment of Bnei Yisrael, but certainly a great deal in shvach of Moshe. So that's a very wonderful biur of this Gemara in Maseches Sota, Kama Chavivas Mitzvahs on Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, an interesting prelude, which is worthwhile noting, to the pursuit of the Mitzrayim is to be found in the beginning of Perek Yud Dalet. And there the psukim read, Perik Yudalad, Vayidaber Hashem, El Moshe Lemor, Daber B'nai Yisrael. Speak to B'nai Yisrael, V'yoshuvu. They've been moving away from Mitzrayim, naturally. And now, the instruction is they should return. V'yachanu lifnei piachiros. And in camp before Piachiros, Ben Migdola, Ben Ayam, Lifnei Baal Tzafon, Nechachos, Sachanu, Al Hayam. So they're given a new position, but the point is they're going backwards. It's the counterintuitive direction, back towards Mitzrayim. The Omar Paro Livnei Yisrael, and Paro will then say concerning Yisrael, Nevuchim Heim Ba'aretz. They are confused. They're lost. That's what the word Nevuchim means. Navoch means confused. The translation of the Mer Nevuchim, it's translated as the guide for the perplexed. The correct translation is the guide for the confused, but I think no one would buy it if you called it that. So it's, everyone is fine to be perplexed. That's good for their resume. Confused is not so good. So Nevuchim Heim Ba'aretz, they're confused in the land, right? They don't know where they're going. Sagar Lehem Amidbar, they're completely enclosed. This says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, B'chizakti Yesle Paro, I will harden Paro's heart, B'radaf HaChareyem, and then you'll see, and that will become Kriyas Yam Sovikovda, B'far V'chochelo, I'll become glorified through Paro and his host, V'yodim Mitzrayim Ki Ani Hashem. So if we would summarize these opening sukkim to Perik Yudalad, we would say that there are two parts. Part number one is B'nai Yisrael need to travel. They need to travel backwards in order to give the impression that they are lost. Part two is, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I will harden Paro's heart. To what end is this? I will harden Paro's heart and he will chase after them. That's really the goal here, is that Paro should chase after them. And there is room here to ask a very simple question. Namely, what is the relationship between these two things, between the traveling backwards of B'nai Yisrael and the hardening of Paro's heart? As if to say, apparently, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't harden Paro's heart, there's no way he's going to travel after them. Lost or not lost, confused or not confused, it's good riddance as far as Paro is concerned. So he's not going to chase after them until Hashem hardens his heart. Without that, it's not going to work. Okay. So Lamaisa then, Hashem hardens his heart. So if Hashem hardens his heart, so then just harden his heart and they can stay where they are. Why do you trouble them to go backwards? And what difference does it make if they're confused or not confused? Hardened his heart means he has no choice but to go after them and just take that route. So if we could paraphrase the classic question of the Gemara, Tarti Lamali, why do I need these two things? In the end of the day, it's not going to happen if you don't harden his heart. And if you harden his heart, so that's that. That should work even without them traveling anywhere. But here we see a corroboration of an idea that we have discussed on previous occasions, which is really developed by the Maase Hashem. Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi in the Maase Hashem in Parshas Lech Lecha, and he discusses a question that Rishonim raised, Rambam, Ramban, many others, namely, how exactly to understand the hardening of Paro's heart vis-a-vis punishing Paro for all the things that he did. As if to say, punishment as we know it comes for making the wrong decision, but you can only be punished for making the wrong decision if you have the capacity to make the right decision. That's why it's wrong to make the wrong decision. If you have no choice but to make the wrong decision, so then how can you be punished for that? That is the question. The question of the Rishonim is summed up in a classic phrase used in modern Hebrew, Zelo fair. That's what they say. That's what it sounds like, as if to say, you don't give him the chance to get it right, and when he gets it wrong, you say, oh, you got it wrong, so now you should be punished. Rambam raises this question in Hilchos Tshuva, and Ramban also in his Perush on the Torah. And along comes the Maase Hashem. The Maase Hashem has such a different approach. It's really it's a new breeze throughout the sugya. We understand as Maase Hashem, if you think about the concept of Hashem hardening Paro's heart, that he so to speak, you know, reached down into his heart and switched it off. And Paro has decision-making faculties, and they were disabled. Says Maase Hashem, it's nothing so drastic, but no less compelling. For actually the concept of hardening Paro's heart is essentially a more natural, we could say, a more natural process. It's a process of manipulating paros middos, manipulating paros. The idea of hardening someone's heart means you leave them with no choice. Many people in life feel that they're left with no choice, given a certain set of circumstances, even though that sounds strange, because isn't it true that a person always has choice, but they don't have meaningful choice unless they're prepared to forego their ego or whatever it may be? If you insult someone repeatedly, you can force him to leave the room. He has no choice but to leave. Well, he always has choice. He can stay there and take abuse if he wants to, but his self-respect will not allow him to do that. Okay, that may be. Whenever you manipulate someone, essentially, in these terms, you harden their heart, because you present them a certain set of data, and then given their way of interpreting it, as far as they're concerned, there is no other way. And you've hardened their heart. People can harden each other's heart. Advertising agencies specialize in this. They leave people with no choice by playing on their insecurities and so on and so forth. That's what happens when Hashem says he's going to harden Paro's heart. He will very simply manipulate Paro's ego. After all, no one likes to admit that they're wrong. And if you're the emperor of Egypt, Kal Vachomer, you do not wish to admit it's not something that you like to do to anyone. Which means all you need to do is to convince Paro that he's right, and then you will essentially leave him no choice but continue along that path, because the alternative is to admit he made a mistake. Well, that's essentially impossible for Paro, even though it's never impossible. And that really is the explanation behind the first meeting between Moshe and Paro. The first meeting, very upsettingly, went badly for us, went badly for Bnei Yisrael, went very well for Paro. Moshe comes, we're all ready, everything should begin. Kom Hashem, shalach ha-semifi avduni, and Paro says, no, I'm not listening, and I'm not fazed by this, and moreover, I'm even going to make things worse. And he seems to be able to get away with it. And no one can understand it. And even, and delicately we say, but even Moshe Rabbeinu comes back and complains. And to complain to Hashem means he feels the pain of Bnei Yisrael, even though he suffered by it. And says, why did you send me? Apparently things are not ready because they just went backwards. Things got worse. Lama ze shlachtani? U'me'oz bosi al paro l'dabe b'shmecha, from the time I came to Paro to speak in your name, heira lama ze. He's only perpetrated more evil to this people. V'hatzelo etzalta esamecha. You have not even begun to save your people. Those are Moshe's words. And what's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response? The final pasuk in Parshas Shemos, Vayomer Hashem, Atah Tireh, with an ayin, Atah Tireh. Now you will see what I'll do to Paro. Ki v'yod hazakai shachem, v'yod hazakai goshem yatsu. Now you'll see, he sent them out, v'yod hazaka. Except the question is, if we're particular, it doesn't seem that Hashem has answered Moshe's question. Because Moshe's question was, why did the first meeting go badly for us? And Hashem's answer is, well, the second meeting will go well. That's actually doesn't answer why the first meeting went badly. Except, says the Ma'asei Hashem, it does. Because one for us and well for Paro, now you'll see. Now everything is in place. Because Paro has concluded that he is stronger than you. He will never change his mind. Because he's Paro. I don't have to do anything else to him now. Atotir'eh, ki b'yod hazaka. And incidentally, according to many Meforshim, the concept Yod Hazaka, when we say Hashem took us out Yod Hazaka, refers to the hardening of Paro's heart. That was the strong hand. Hashem hardened his heart. Hashem says, now his heart has been hardened. And therefore, says Ma'asei Hashem, when we look upon the hardening of Paro's heart in this, what we would call, more natural way, we'll appreciate that the question that bothered all the Rishonim is not an actual, well, doesn't need to bother us anymore. Because if the question is, if he had no choice, how can you punish him? He didn't have no choice in that way. He can always do the right thing. If his ego doesn't allow him to, well, that's his problem. But he can't claim asylum based on that. No one can ever say, I shouldn't be held accountable for my actions because my ego left me no other choice. So you should be held accountable for that. And the truth is that each and every makkah, as we've discussed at certain points over the years, each and every makkah had some type of loophole that Paro could latch onto if he wanted to say, haha, you see, it didn't happen exactly in the way that they said. Even to the point, as we saw in last week's parsha, Makkas Bechoros, Makkah number 10, Moshe still has to say Kachatzos HaLaila, that they shouldn't be looking at the stopwatches, and if it's not Mamish Chatzos, you know, L'chol Adeos, precisely, so then they'll still feel that they won. This is the approach of the Maaseh Hashem, a very important contribution to that discussion, a great deal to think about. And the truth is, it's possible to say, the Maaseh Hashem is one of the early Acharonim, but the idea preceded him. And the idea, again, is to be found in the Droshes Haran. From a certain point of view, it's black and white in the Torah. Because in our Parsha, which is the last instance of hardening Paro's heart, getting into chase after Bnei Yisrael into the Yamsuf, we see once again that it took the place of giving Paro a situation that he would misread. It's not purely a question of hardening his heart and out he comes, but rather how will Hashem harden his heart? The way that he'll harden his heart is by giving him the impression that the Jewish people are confused and lost in the desert. And then Paro, once again, he'll be looking to reclaim his former glory and says, you see, that's what I'm saying. I don't know how they got out, but look, clearly that power has abandoned them. They're lost. They're wandering around. And therefore, if the question was, why do you need two things? Getting them to give the impression that they're lost and hardening his heart, the answer is, these are one thing. It is through giving Paro the impression that they're lost that his heart is hardened. Because all the while, that's the way his heart has been hardened, by giving him a situation for him to misread the way that he wants to, so that he will feel that he was right. And therefore, that's an important part of this discussion. Comes mamish at the end. In terms of the parsha, it comes at the end, but as we see, it's from the Ran who preceded the Maaseh Hashem, and that's also something well worthwhile thinking about. Let's, I would say, cut to the chase, but we're in the chase already. And if we take a look at a Rashi in Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Hey, so we'll see an interesting thing that Rashi says. And Rashi's giving us the timeline, actually, because, you know, we left Mitzrayim, but then it was 7 days. How did it work? We'd say we'd go for 3 days, and then we didn't come back. And Rashi, in the Dibur, but you got the Melech Mitzrayim, and Rashi says that Paro sent scouts with them, just to kind of chaperone them and monitor them. And then Rashi says, V'keven shehigiu l'shloshes yomim, shekav'u l'elech v'lashuv, since at the time that it came to 3 days, they said they'd go and come back, v'ra'u she'enom chosen l'mitzvah. That, of course, was a bit of a surprise for these chaperones. Bo'u v'gidu l'par b'yomarvi. So on day 4 of Pesach, they came back to Paro and said, they're not coming back. Paro, basically the Jewish people keep on traveling, and Paro takes 2 days to catch up with them. In the eve before the 7th day, they all went down into the sea. Some of them came up on the other side. The Shachris Omru Shira. And in that morning, the following morning, they said Shira. That's the 7th day of Pesach. So that's Pesach in a nutshell, basically, that timeline. And then says Rashi, Lachach anu korim hashira b'yom hashvi. That's why we read the Shira on the 7th day, which we do. The laning for 7th day of Pesach is Azi Hashir. Very nice. From the beginning of Bishalach. So what's very interesting is, this Rashi is most unusual. I think it's the only place where Rashi comments on a section of the Torah and explains why we read it on a certain day in the year. It has no parallel, I don't believe. Rashi doesn't say that we read the Avodas Yom Kippur on Yom Kippur. He doesn't say that we read about Matan Torah on Shavuos. And by the way, it's not Rashi's job to tell us the laning. I mean, the Gabbai, that's his job. And Rashi's job is to explain the Pasuk. The Pasuk is what it is. And therefore, you know, that's why we read Shira Sayam on the 7th of Pesach. How come Rashi took that extra step here to lead us towards the laning on a yearly basis? Now, there's a very interesting Shiloh which is discussed in the Mishnah, actually, in Maseches Sota, with regards to Shira Tayam. You see, the interesting question about Shira Tayam, if you ever picture it, Azir Shem Moshe, Uvenei Yisrael, Shira Zot, they all sang the Shira. And it's worthwhile asking, how did they know the Shira? Well, Moshe is Moshe, so he knows, because he's a Navi, and he gets the Shira. How does everyone else know the Shira? I mean, you know, they don't have Sidurim with Oz Yashir. It hasn't happened yet. And everyone, they're all singing. I mean, what are we to picture? And interestingly here, there is a machlokas, how to understand the situation, and the central word, actually, is the word lemor in the end of the first pasuk of the Shira. Shira, of course, begins in Perek Tesvav, pasuk Aleph. Az Yashem Moshe, Ubnei Yisrael, Asashira Zos Lashem, Vayamru lemor. Now, actually, if you think about it, the word lemor can certainly be seen as redundant because it says Vayamru, and they said. So what does lemor mean? And they said, saying. It's difficult, it's awkward a little bit. And therefore, what does the word lemor mean? Lemor means to say. Well, what does that mean? That means that Moshe was to say something and they were to say something else. How does it work? So there are three opinions in the Mishnah there. The first opinion is Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva understands that actually it was only really Moshe who said the Shira. In his words, it's kegodol hamakra es halal. Like the Chazan says halal. The way we say halal is not the way halal was originally said. The way halal was originally said, only the Chazan said halal. And at the certain key points, the tzibur would say haleluka, just to stay connected to the halal. But the Chazan would really say the halal and be motzi everyone. And Rabbi Kiva says, that's what happened here. Moshe would say a pasuk of the Shira, another pasuk, and Bnei Yisrael would say Ashira Lashem. You see the way, every time. That was their refrain. That was their chorus. So, Vayomu lemor, Ashira Lashem. All Moshe says is, I'm going to say the Shira, and what you need to say is Ashira Lashem. Very interesting. Okay. Others say that it's not kegodol she'omer sahala, like an adult who says the hala, but kekoton ha'omer sahala, like a child who says hala. What's the point? Why would a child say halal? If no one else knows the halal, the child says halal. But he can't be motzi anyone, so they need to repeat after him, pasuk by pasuk. And that's how it worked, says the second opinion. Kekotan hamakri es halal. Which means, and again, lemor means, repeat after me. So he would first say that pasuk of Shira, and then they would say that pasuk. Okay. The third opinion in the Mishnah there, which is Rabbi Nehemiah, actually understands that at that point, Nevuah kind of took over all of Am Yisrael, and therefore Moshe just had to get them going, and then they all had a spirit of Nevuah, and everybody knew Az Yashir, and they all said it themselves. And that the paradigm for that is like someone who says Shema. What's the point? Because how does Ma'ariv work, for example? The Chazan says Baruch Hu, everyone says Baruch Hu, and they're off. Yeah, and everybody knows what to do at that stage. They just need the trigger, and then everyone says by themselves. So it's, and again, that's also lemor. Lemor means for everyone to say it, but then everyone had found within themselves the knowledge and the wherewithal to say it. So this is a very interesting discussion amongst Tanoim, to be found in the Mishnah, how exactly Oz Yashir went. And as we said, it's all based around the word lemor. What's very interesting is, if we just stay for a moment with this third opinion of Rabbi Nehemiah, Moshe started them off, and then everybody knew it. The way that this is described in the Tosefta of Sota is very interesting. Rabbi Nehemiah Omer, you know what it's like? Kibnei Adam shekorin Shema bebeis haKnesset. It's like the way people read Shema at Shul. They just need to be kicked off, and they can all go. Shneemar az Hashem Moshe, lemor. What does lemor mean? Melamed shehaya Moshe poteach b'davar tchila. Moshe just had to start them off. V'Yisrael onen acharav v'gomim imo. And then everybody said after him and finished together with him. But once he started them, they all knew it. Moshe amar az Yashir, Moshe, and Yisrael said, Ashir el Hashem ki ka'oka ah, and then they all knew it. So what's very interesting about this Tosefta is that it stamps the beginning of the Shira for Moshe with the words Az Yashir Moshe. Now the reason why that's so interesting is because there might be room to understand that the words Az Yashir aren't words that Moshe said. See, really the question is, it's a very basic question, what is the first word of Shira Sayam? We call it Az Yashir. But when you think about it, for the most part, the Torah is narrating. The Torah tells us what happened. And then once in a while, the Torah says what people said. Well, what did people say? In other words, the Torah has been describing the chase and Kriyas Yamsuf, and then the Bnei Yisrael were saved. And then it says, Az Yashir Moshe, and then Moshe sang. And what did they say? This is the point. If you could imagine, when does the Shira begin? One could have understood it begins with the words, Ashir El Hashem Ki Ga'oga'a, because at that point, the Torah is no longer narrating, but rather it's quoting what they said. Amazingly, from the Tosefta, we see that actually the beginning of the Shira is Az Yashir. The first words that Moshe said of the Shira was Moshe said Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael. He gave it the own prelude to the Shira, and it's part of the Shira. And interestingly, it's possible to say that there are one could even say halachic ramification. What difference does it make where the Shira begins? Well, as you know, if you've ever looked in a Sefer Torah, you know that the Shira Sayam is written quite differently than everything else. Everything else is written more or less word after word, line after line. But Shira Sayam has that what's called Ariach Agabe Levena, the half bricks on the whole bricks. It has that kind of staggered, and that's a halacha, how the Sefer Torah should be written, how the Shira should be written. So now the question is, at what point should the words be written like that? Where does the Shira begin? Now it becomes a question. And actually, if you look in the Rambam and Hilchas Sefer Torah, you will see that he actually presents what the Shira looks like, and you have that staggered writing already from the words Az Yashir Moshe, because it's part of the Shira. If it was the introduction to the Shira, but the Shira doesn't begin until the words Ashir El Hashem, that you wouldn't have to write it that way until you get to Ashir El Hashem. But actually, the Shira already begins with the words Az Yashir. And interestingly, this, one could say, is supported by an interesting comment of the Medrash on the word Az. Az Yashir Moshe, then Moshe sang. And everybody's wondering, you know, when is then? Az Yashir Moshe, then? When? And that's actually a machlokus Rishonim. But the word Az is a motif word. And the Medrash says that actually, by beginning the Shira with the word Az, aside from the time stamp of whenever it was, Moshe was rectifying something. Because Moshe actually came to mishap through the word Az. The pasuk that we quoted, because he came and complained to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with the word Az. Umei Az bas yel paro ledaber b'shmecha heirala amazeh. The Moshe says, I took a wrong term with the word Az. Let me take a right term with the word Az. I made a mistake with me Az Bas Yel Shemecha. Let me rectify Az Yashir Moshe. So that Medrash, which itself needs to be pondered as to how one is the rectification for the other, but what we do see is that the words Az Yashir Moshe are Moshe's words. He's already talking. This is already the beginning of the Shira. So that's a very interesting Shaila. It's not so simple for us to conclude this. That the Shira Siyam begins with the description, Az Yashir. Those are the first words sung by Moshe and Bnei Yisrael. But as a concluding note, it's worthwhile referring to the Yerushalmi. For the Yerushalmi says that the word Lemor, and again, that's the word that everybody's watching. What does it mean by Yemu Lemor? Lemor means, says Yerushalmi, Ledoros, in future generations. Lemor, to say, this song was said to be said. Dayomru Lemor. They said, say this. But they're saying it. No, later on it should be said. When? In future generations. And what that means is that there's something about Shiras Hayam whereby already from within the Shira itself, we're being told this should be said in subsequent generation. When on Shvi'i Shel Pesach? In other words, there's something unique about saying the Shira on the seventh day of Pesach when it happened, rather different, beyond all the other things that we read about in the Torah when they happened. We read about Matan Torah on Shavuos because the Torah was given on Shavuos. But the Torah doesn't say to read about Matan Torah on Shavuos. We read about Avodas Yom Kippur because it happened on Yom Kippur, but the Torah doesn't say to read about it on Yom Kippur. But a unique category is Shiras Hayam, because the Torah itself said this should be said. This should be said at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when it happened every year on Shvi'i Shel Pesach, Leimor. So this should be said. And some suggest the Sefer Imri Chen, contemporary Mechaber, Rabbi Yehuda Levenberg, suggests that that's why Rashi made mention of the fact that we Zachi never told us anything else that we lain. But here it's actually in response to the word Leimor, something the Torah itself is saying, and therefore Rashi is responding to that idea in the Pasuk. And so we have some very interesting points to consider, some rather quite, I would say, elemental questions. Where does the Shira begin? How exactly was the Shira said? And the answer to all of that and more comes from the word Leimor. I'd like to just move to the end of the parsha, which is Vayavo Amalek. It's the laning for Purim. And they're the last nine psukim of Parshas Beshalach. And Vayavar Amalek is Perik Yudzayin Pasuk Ches. He seems to come out of the blue, Vayavar Amalek, but there is background. Because what was mentioned before is Bnei Yisrael complaining. The last words just before this parsha are the Jewish people tested Hashem, so to speak. Hayesh Hashem b'kibeinu imayim. Is Hashem with us? Is he not with us? Is he going to take care of us? Is he not going to take care of us? And Rashi himself says, what do you mean? Hashem has been taking care of you the whole time. It seems Bnei Yisrael were reluctant to recognize Hashem's kindness with them on an ongoing basis, and they took an opportunity to complain, which was not correct. This is one of the ten nisyonos, Nisu Avesenos HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bamidbar. And the result was, the response was, Amalek. How does Amalek become a response for the Jewish people kind of talking in this way? So there's a very interesting comment of the Mechilta. And the Mechilta says the Jewish people acted in an ungrateful manner. The Jewish people are us. We tend to identify them normally only when they do the right thing, like receiving the Torah, but we're always the Jewish people, even when we do the wrong thing. So the Mechilta says that was a lack of gratitude. What about everything he's done for you? And therefore, that put us in a category called Kefuye Tova, people who are ungrateful. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so if you are ungrateful, Yavo Kefuye Tova, so let someone who is ungrateful come, and he will exact retribution from those who are ungrateful. As if to say, the connection between Amalek and us is that when we acted ungratefully, so Amalek comes in. That empowers Amalek, because Amalek is also ungrateful. The Shaila is, where is Amalek ungrateful? We don't really have a history of Amalek. We don't have much positive to say about him, but we're not specifically aware that being ungrateful is a trait of Amalek. The Sefer Shiras David has a very interesting explanation, suggestion. Firstly, an important question, Vayavo Amalek, who is Amalek? And when I say who is Amalek, what I mean is, are we talking about Amalek? It was originally a person, the grandson of Esau. So there's a person called Amalek, and then he developed a nation. That nation's called Amalek. When we say Vayavo Amalek, do we mean the person Amalek? Is he still around? Or do we mean the nation Amalek? How can we tell? Actually, there is a way to tell, because the Pasuk says, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, interesting to look at it like this, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayachalosh Yoshua, Es Amalek ve'es Amo lefi charev. Yeshua subdued Amalek and his people lefi charev, by the sword. Except the question is, well, I thought Amalek was the people. The people are called Amalek. That's where of Amalek. Well, apparently, Amalek, the person, is still there. His nation are also called Amalek. But you can see that Amalek, the original Amalek, is there. Amalek be'es Amo. And the Das Akenim in Balei HaTosfos quote a Medrash, because if it's really Amalek, so let's ask a simple Shaila. Amalek has been around for a while, obviously, and he doesn't like the Jewish people, seemingly, and wants to destroy them. So now the question is, timing. Why does he wait so long before attacking them? And by the way, there's a subtext to the question. Amalek must be kicking himself, because 200 years ago there were 70 of them. And now there's like a couple of million of them. So that was, looking back, you know, in retrospect, it wasn't the best thing to wait. He would have had much chance, presumably, when there was just like a few, a handful of them. But he waited. Why did he wait? Says the Medrash, because Amalek couldn't bring himself to attack them before they went down to Mitzrayim. Because Avram was foretold, Yadoa Tedaki Geria Zaracha Be'eretz Elohim, your descendants will be a stranger in a land which is not theirs. They'll be enslaved. They'll be persecuted. And as we know, Esav very graciously deferred to Yaakov to experience that. And therefore, says the Medrash, Amalek didn't want to attack Bnei Yisrael before they went out to Mitzrayim, because he thought that if he attacks them, so then he'll be the one that will have to go down to Mitzrayim. He wants to keep them around so that they can be motzi everyone in Geria, Zaracha, etc. and so forth. Once that's happened, even though there's many more of them, that's the point that he chooses to attack. That's a very interesting Medrash. But the point is, for us, David, perhaps now we understand why Amalek is referred to as Kfui Tova, as being ungrateful. In their own estimation, the Jewish people just performed a kindness for them, just performed a service for them. You kept them around so that they could experience Golas Mitzrayim for you. You thought if it's not them, it's going to be you. And how do you show your gratitude? By attacking them. That's why Amalek are referred to as Kfui Tova. Where's your appreciation? When Yisrael underwent Golas Mitzrayim for you. You should be thanking them. You should make a kiddush for them. But Amalek attacks them. That's the Kfui Tova. And what's important to mention as well is that we see there's always this synergy, this symbiosis between being ungrateful vis-a-vis people and ungrateful vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just like the Medrash says about Paro. Today he says, Lo Yadai Es Yosef, he doesn't know Yosef. Tomorrow, Lo Yadati Es Hashem, he doesn't know Hashem. If he's not prepared to acknowledge kindness from people, he will not be prepared to acknowledge kindness from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He doesn't mean he'll be beholden to anyone. And therefore, Amalek are famous for refusing to recognize Hashem's involvement in the world. They don't want to be beholden to him. They don't want to be accountable to him. And it's the same middah. They won't recognize the kindness done to them from Bnei Yisrael, that they themselves were precipitated or allowed to happen. And certainly they would not acknowledge any kindness from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the middah of Amalek, or one of its classic middahs. And one of the reasons why we read about Amalek is in order to be aware of that middah and be able to avoid it. I'll just mention in conclusion a wonderful comment that I came across this week in the writings of Rabbi Yosef Nechemia Kornitzer of Krakow. And it relates to Moshe's hands. Moshe's hands, when his hands are raised, everything's good, the Jewish people are winning, and when his hands are lowered, then they're losing. The Pasuk says, Yud Aleph Vayak Hasher Yarim Moshe Yadov V'Gavar Yisrael, when his hands are raised, they are successful. Victorious because when his hands are lowered, the Gavar Amalek. And the Mishnah in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and Daf Kaptes famously asked the question. I think Rashi even quotes it. That's it. All you need to do is have Moshe's hands raised. V'chiyodav shel Moshe osas mochama or shervas mochama. His hands are up. That's all you need. There's much more to it than that, says the Mishnah. Rather, Ella Lomalav to tell you that when his hands are raised, it represents a certain mindset of the Jewish people. Bezman she Yisrael mistaken klapei mala, they're looking, their eyes are raised on high. Mishabdin es libam laviyim shir hashamayim, they subjugate their hearts to their Father in heaven. Then they would succeed. If not, then they're in trouble. And in a sense, the marker for that, Moshe's hands. So what's the secret to Bnei Yisrael succeeding here in the war, represented by Moshe's hands, is to what degree are their eyes raised on high? do they subjugate themselves to their Father in heaven? That's the secret of their success. That's the tools of their success. Yosef Nechemia says, there's another element here. Al-derech hadrush. Al-derech hadrush, but the yasod is emes. We know that this is not the last time we're going to meet Amalek. And one of the prime areas of vulnerability for the Jewish people when Haman later comes along is that there's pirud, there's separateness, and there's discord amongst the Jewish people. Yeshno am echad mefuzar u'mefored ben kol ha'amim. They're separate, they're apart from each other. And what Haman needs to say is, if they're apart from each other, they're vulnerable. And that's why part of the rectification and the salvation of the Jewish people began with the words Lech kenos es kol ha'yehudim. The Jewish people have to get together. They can't afford to be apart. When the Jewish people are together as one, that's their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, their connection to each other. That's what makes them successful. If they're apart from each other, they're in serious trouble. Says Rabbi Yosef Nechemia, that was true in Haman's time. It was true from the very beginning. But how do the Jewish people come together? Everyone talks about unity. It's very easy to talk about. Slightly harder to accomplish. What's the secret? Says Rabbi Yosef Nechemia, one thing is tried and tested. Everyone has good points and bad points. If you focus on the bad points, you will always find a reason to remain apart from that person. Me, connect with him or with her. She's like this, she's like this. But everyone has good points. And if you focus on the good points, you'll be drawn towards, people will be drawn towards each other. That's the recipe. To focus on the positive in other people brings people together. To focus on the negative in other people keeps them apart. And therefore, says Rabbi Yosef Nechemia, you know, it's interesting, the Pasuk Yud Aleph says, Vayakashe Yarim Moshe Yado. When Moshe's hand is raised, isn't it interesting that it shifts from hands to hand, from plural to singular? The Pasuk says, in the next Pasuk, V'yidei Moshe Kvedim. We always talk about Moshe's hand, but this Pasuk talks about Moshe's hand. Yad Moshe, throughout Chazal, throughout the Chumash Api Chazal, has a specific connotation. Yad Moshe is always a throwback to that time that Moshe pointed out a flaw within the Jewish people and was punished for it. V'hein le'yaminu li, they won't believe me, like we saw a few weeks ago. And he focused unnecessarily on, dwelled on the negative with too much conviction, and he received tzaraas. And from that point on, Yad Moshe always remembers, focus on the positive, not on the negative. Says Rabbi Yosef Nechemia, the way to read the Mishnah in this light is, once again, Moshe's hand, when his hand is up, why does that make a difference? Because when Moshe's hand is up, people remember the lesson from Moshe's hand. Does it win the war? Here's how it wins the war. Ela bizman she Yisrael mistaklim klape mala. They look at the mala. Everyone has a mala. Everyone has a positive. Everyone has good qualities. Everyone has a chisoron. The question is, what's the lesson of Moshe's hand? Mistako klapi mala. Look at the mala. And then mishtab nizdib l'avin shashamayim. When everybody gets together because they focus on the positive in each other, that brings them closer to each other, closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's when they are victorious. So that's the way to succeed is embedded in the very first meeting between us and Amalek. It replays itself, and it's still a concern. But at least something I believe very profound and also very helpful given to us by Rabbi Nechemia. Such a simple idea. Mestakan klape mala will bring people together. That's a lesson, as it always was in Mitzvah Hashem, will be again as we take the lesson and conclude things once and for all. B'meheir yamin.
We have opinion.